Welcome to the Friedreich Ataxia edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the FA community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. Our guest for today's podcast is Kathleen Lutz, Vice President of the Jackson Laboratory's Rare Disease Translational Center. The laboratory, also known as JAX, is a nonprofit biomedical research institution headquartered in Bar Harbor, Maine. For the past 7 years, the center has worked with dozens of rare disease foundations and their associated research teams to generate custom mouse models that represent rare conditions in order to pursue new therapeutic interventions. Thank you, Dr. Lutz, for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Please tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. I'm a geneticist and a neuroscientist by training. I've worked in research mostly with mouse models. Back in the day before genetic engineering, we worked with a lot of spontaneous mutations to look at human disease and see if we could make some correlations between the genes that we were studying in mice and the conditions that were in the patient population. And today we have, much better tools and skill sets for this. Genetic engineering is not only, something that we've been doing for a dozen or more years, but it's becoming much easier now. So taking a genetic mutation that exists in a person and genetically engineering it into a mouse model so that we can better study the disease itself and also apply therapeutics to that particular mouse model to possibly predict what might happen in the clinic is something that my lab and the work at the Translational Center at JAX has been doing for quite some time.
Is your center associated with any institution of higher learning or university?
Actually, no. We're a private research institution. We're very heavily funded by NIH, but essentially this is a nonprofit research institution, and as you know, located in Bar Harbor, Maine. So it's quite a unique place and a unique institution.
How many rare diseases are you currently researching?
Oh, that's a loaded question, but I'm going to probably say more than 70 and less than 150, if I'm being honest. I have quite a large group of individuals working for me. And so when we work with foundations and patients, it could be, very intensely in terms of sort of seeing them through the entire pipeline of what is the genetic mutation, what is the mouse that we need to make, how is the mouse presenting, what's the natural history study of the patients, do we have a natural history study, are we looking for biomarkers, are we testing therapeutics? That really spans the gamut. And then sometimes we're just, simply helping connect mouse models with different researchers and, really facilitating, making those research connections for folks.
Right. And Friedreich ataxia is a relatively rare condition, progressive neuromuscular disease. We understand it affects between 1 in 40,000 to 50,000 people of European origin. And that translates into what, about 5,000 Americans with the disease currently?
Yeah, the 1 in 40,000 individuals with a carrier frequency of 1 in 100 is the stats for Friedreich's ataxia. And actually, it is considered to be a rare disease, but it's actually one of the more common rare diseases, especially for a hereditary ataxia.
How long have you been working with this particular disease?
Wow, I'm going to say more than a dozen years. Ron Bartek, who you may know, who is the head of the Friedreich's Ataxia Research Alliance and initiated that, he actually approached me, I think it was probably 12 years ago, if it wasn't more, really coming to me asking if we, the Jackson Laboratory, could really get behind Friedreich's Ataxia. And of course, if you know Ron, he's probably one of the most convincing and charming individuals you'll ever meet. So it was pretty hard to say no to him.
Yes. In fact, we interviewed him earlier this year, right after the FDA approval of Skyclarys, which happened to fall on Rare Disease Day, February 28th. And as we understand, that marked the first drug ever granted authorization by the FDA to treat the disease.
That's correct. Yes.
So now that we have a drug that can treat it, what is the focus of your research currently?
Oh, I think we're going to continue we're going to continue marching on for the therapeutics in that regard. I think that this drug is good. I think it's a great start for patients with Friedreich's ataxia, but I do think there are additional therapeutics, especially those therapeutics that work directly on the gene and gene augmentation therapeutics, that can be, you know, really powerful and very much complementary to this particular drug.
So you're not involved at all in human clinical trials, strictly mouse models, correct?
Yeah, we focus primarily on the preclinical work.
And that preclinical work, roughly how much of that eventually makes it to human trials?
Well, I think, you know, it's getting more and more these days. We've had a number of projects where we've worked with gene therapy and gene augmentation to look at loss of function, or even with Friedreich's ataxia, for example. You know, these are diseases of low protein, no protein, and we've been able to use gene therapy and gene augmentation strategies as a therapeutic. Now, a lot of what actually makes it to the clinic, it's a complicated pathway, and we're working with NIH and other industry partners, if you will, so that we get those therapeutics to the clinic a little bit more readily than we had before. Gene augmentation is somewhat new, and it's not new. It's been around for a long time. I think there's many therapeutics for example, for SMA that involve gene therapy, and they are quite powerful and work really well. However, we still have a long road ahead of us for some diseases like Friedreich's ataxia, where the delivery of that gene therapy can be really challenging, especially if we're trying to get into the CNS, and especially if we're trying to treat older patients and not neonates, if you will. So I think that the potential for gene therapy is really there. And I think somebody recently likened it, you know, to advances in technologies. Well, when they first come out, you know, they can be expensive and they can be hard to navigate. But then as the technology becomes more mainstream, the cost is lower, and, you know, you have more options in terms of those therapeutics. So we and others, and I'm sure you know there's many companies who work in industry on gene therapy, really feel that this is a viable therapeutic approach, not just for Friedreich's ataxia, but for a number of different rare diseases.
Right. And interesting that you mentioned SMA, because several years ago we interviewed Dr. Adrian Craner at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in Long Island, New York, talking about the development of Spinraza for SMA. I just wanted to ask you, in our interview with Ron Bartek, he said according to the clinical data trial, the this drug, Skyclarys, slows the progression of Friedreich's ataxia by about 55%, giving them a few more years of quality of life, but does not actually cure the disease. What you're talking about is something that can actually strike at the root cause of the ataxia, correct?
That's correct. And we do feel that for many years, therapeutics, especially small molecules, especially with industry, have maybe focused on upstream or downstream pathways, alleviating symptoms, giving support, if you will, to, you know, to the mitochondria in this case, and making the disease a little, I'm going to say, less progressive. And so, as you noted, that the patients have a greater quality of life for a longer period of time. With gene therapy and gene augmentation, we're really looking at the root cause. What is the genetic mutation? And let's, you know, use that as our therapeutic target.
We've seen a flurry of FDA approvals in recent years for gene therapies in everything from Duchenne muscular dystrophy to hemophilia. Just a few months ago, of course, the new drug for Duchenne was approved, giving patients hope that perhaps they never had before. At the same time, we've also seen the rise of artificial intelligence and the role of AI in clinical trials. And from what I understand, adapting AI can dramatically speed up the time, not only finding patients, but also finding doctors and sites to conduct those trials. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I sure can. You know, I think that this is really important because the best science in the world, and especially the work that we do from a preclinical standpoint, has to get into patients. You know, we need to find the patient population, the natural history of the patients needs to be, you know, clear and on target. And the design of those clinical trials needs to be informative. There's many examples of drugs that may or may not have necessarily worked, but the clinical trial may not have been clear enough in order to give you that answer. And so the idea of finding these patients using, you know, health records and more than just what I'm going to say is, you know, social media, where patient populations came together because they found each other through these avenues, really looking at health records of these patients and understanding what their disease progression is and has been is really important. But then I also think in the clinical trials themselves, you know, clinical outcome measures that are based on artificial intelligence in terms of looking at algorithms around movement, patients having wearables so that we can really understand what their movement is in their natural home setting, you know, as opposed to going, you know, hundreds or thousands of miles to a clinic and asking a patient to do a 6-minute walk test. It's somewhat of an artificial, you know, staging, if you will. And so I think that there's so many different technologies around monitoring the clinical trials themselves, in addition to finding those patients and their natural history, which is really going to help this process.
Wonderful. We're almost out of time. I just wanted to ask you one last thing. And as they say, follow the money. And as Ron Bartek told us not long ago, this Skyclarys is a quite expensive drug, retailing for about $375,000 per year. And while the funding for this drug will come from, of course, insurance companies and, you know, government assistance and the manufacturer Reata itself, you mentioned that as time goes on, obviously the price should come down. How do you see this affecting people with Friedreich ataxia in the long term?
Yeah, I think that this question of pricing, especially for rare diseases, and as I mentioned before, Friedreich's ataxia is actually one of the more common hereditary ataxias, to the point where you have companies who are willing to sort of get involved in the therapeutics because there is enough of a patient population for them to treat and enough of a patient population for them to make a return on their investment. And these are industries, you know, they're companies, they have stockholders, and this is what they're meant to do. And I think that that's very reasonable, but because there are so few wins, you know, sometimes in rare diseases, and I'm hoping that's really gonna change, the price for that drug can be higher. In addition, you know, I think you have to look beyond this current therapeutic and know that there are gene therapy strategies and augmentation strategies coming down the pipeline. And so there may be a very limited window for this drug to really, you know, sort of see its profitability, if you will. I do think the pricing has to change. You know, for SMA, we also know the price tag is millions of dollars for a one-time therapeutic treatment. And I think that this is a real, you know, issue with our medical system, and we're going to have to really think to address it. I will say that for some rare diseases, there aren't even enough of a patient population for companies to be interested. And then you have a whole other model, if you will, a financial model, where people are trying to develop therapeutics where the patient population isn't large enough to really support a return on the investment. And so I think that we really need to, you know, turn this this system on its ear a little bit and think about how we're going to do this differently, because it's not sustainable and it's certainly not a solution for the ultra rare diseases.
Dr. Lutz, thank you so much for talking with us. Appreciate your time. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.